I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. Artificial intelligence is a part of all of our lives, from our social media feeds and the development of vaccines to virtual assistants like Siri and Alexa and facial recognition technology. It's used in hiring, manufacturing, policing, surveillance, communication, banking, warfare, autonomous vehicles. There's more. And like all technologies, it can be a force for good or for bad or for both. Today on Radio Times, meet the hosts of the new podcast, AI Nation, which is a collaboration between WHYY and Princeton University. Ed Felton is a professor of computer science and founding director of Princeton's Center for Information Technology Policy. He joined us by Skype. And Ed Felton, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me on.
You're very welcome. As I said, we have two hosts here. The other host is Malcolm Burnley, a contributing reporter to WHYY. Malcolm, nice to have you with us as well.
Hi, Marty. It's great to be here.
Nice to have you with us. The five-part series explores how AI has evolved over the years, the problems it has solved, some of the ethical questions it raises, the problematic applications, including things like racial bias and where the technology is going. Are robot overlords waiting for us in the future? You can download a podcast of AI Nation wherever you get your podcasts, and you can join us on Radio Times. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can give us a call at 1-888-477-9499 about anything AI. Ed Felton, I do want to begin with you, and this is probably the most boring way to start a interview, but I do feel like we need to make sure that everyone is all on the same page. When we say the words artificial intelligence, what are we referring to? What does that mean, especially in 2021?
Sure. Really what it means is AI is really any kind of system where a computer is doing something that we would say is intelligent if we saw a person doing it. Usually that means dealing with a complex situation and being able to adapt to changes in the environment around it. So this is things like learning by trial and error or learning from examples, figuring out how to function in a complex situation.
Go ahead, Ed.
No, please.
Okay, well, let me jump in here. I'll go to you, Malcolm. From your perspective and from your experience doing this podcast, when you began, what did you think about AI? What did you even know about AI?
Yeah, I mean, I think I was obviously the novice in the duo of our hosting on the topic. And I think a lot of my conception of AI was informed very much by science fiction, you know, growing up, watching movies, reading books. And, you know, I think the prevailing, probably predominant vision of what AI is or was going to be was mechanical people or, you know, some version that looked like humanoids. And I think one of the shocking things about this podcast was realizing that we're currently in this stage where AI is getting integrated or is already integrated, as you laid out at the beginning, in so many facets of our lives. And it's no longer this question of, you know, should we or shouldn't we do this? It's a question of how are we going to do this?
Because we're here. It's happening, as you say, it is all around us. Ed, let me go back to you, and I'm going to ask for another definition, and this is the word intelligence. So when we talk about intelligence, I think we understand what human intelligence is about. Help us understand what computer intelligence involves.
Well, there's a lot of debate about that among experts, among philosophers, what we mean by intelligence. But we sort of know it when we see it. The thing that is really distinctive about machine intelligence or AI, and this kind of goes back to the sci-fi point that Malcolm brought up a minute ago, is that it's not like human intelligence. It's a different kind of thing. These AI systems tend to be specialized. They might be really good at one thing, but entirely clueless at everything else that people know how to do. And there's something about them and how they work that is deeply mysterious. They work on different principles than human intelligence. And so it can be hard to understand how they work or hard to even predict where they're going to do well and where they're going to fall down.
Let me quote, this is a woman named Melanie Mitchell. She wrote a book called Artificial Intelligence, A Guide for Thinking Humans. And she wrote, the things that we humans do without much thought, looking out in the world and making sense of what we see, carrying on a conversation, walking down a crowded sidewalk without bumping into anyone, turn out to be the hardest challenges for machines. She goes on to say, conversely, it's often easier to get machines to do things that are very hard for humans. For example, solving complex mathematical problems, mastering games like chess and Go, translating sentences between hundreds of languages have all turned out to be relatively easier for machines. From your perspective, Ed, does that make sense to you?
It absolutely does. We've learned sort of by experience which things AI systems can do and which they can't. And they just seem to be good at different sorts of things than we are. Many of the things they're good at are important and have a lot of economic value, but there are some things that people still are able to do in ways that are beyond the machines, even if the machines are amazing at some other tasks.
Malcolm, what was the thing that really surprised you about AI?
Well, just along those lines, just to give an example kind of to illustrate the difference between artificial intelligence and human intelligence, we spoke to a number of physicists and talked about how artificial intelligence might help us stop or prevent, or at least accelerate the response to a future pandemic or a future, you know, medical crisis. And one of the scientists we spoke to has devoted his whole life to what's known as the protein folding problem, which is in biology and physics. And to just boil it down to really simple terms, the shape of a protein in the human body or in the world is essential to finding out what it can and can't do. And some scientists will spend decades or even their entire career just studying the shape of a single protein. And over the last several years, there's been huge advancements in machine learning and artificial intelligence that has actually solved the protein folding problem. And so what he told me was this incredible example of they gave artificial intelligence the task to solve this really complicated equation about protein folding. And in order to solve it, the artificial intelligence essentially invented its own kind of physics. It had never been taught physics. It didn't know, you know, what the abstraction of physics is, but it created its own type of physics to solve this problem. And what's incredible about it is not only the fact that it did something that, you know, scientists have been working their whole lives to do, but it's that we don't actually fully know how it solved this. We know that it is able to produce the shape of a protein, is able to solve this incredibly complicated challenge. But just to illustrate what Ed was saying, because it's different than human intelligence, we can't necessarily crack it open and see, oh, it made this logical leap to get to here. We can kind of only see the outputs. So it was both incredible in this example of what it can do, but then also these kind of blind spots. And I guess to a degree, we have to accept intelligence on its own.
Well, Ed, let me go back to you. And in this podcast, you talk about Eliza. And I remember this must have been, in the 1980s, maybe 1990s, you know, hearing Eliza. She was a robotic psychotherapist, a very sort of Rogerian therapist, in that you would say, I'm really angry at my father. And she would say, well, why are you so angry at your father? Or some version of that. And it obviously had its limitations, but was that a breakthrough of any sort at that time?
I think it was a breakthrough in a couple of ways. One was that it was a very early system which was able to use human language in a way that people would accept. But then the other really interesting thing about Eliza was that even though it was kind of this mirror that just bounced back at you what you had said in the form of a question, that when you put people into a chat room with it, they projected a whole human identity onto it. They felt like it really understood them and that they were having a deep and meaningful conversation with a therapist, even though they knew that this was just a computer system. There's something about the way we interact with computers that makes us want to project a sort of a humanness onto them, even when the evidence is really not there. And so that was something that Eliza showed early on, and it's something that deeply affects the way we interact with these AI systems at times. We can give them more credit than they really deserve because they seem like they're intelligent. They seem like a person in some ways.
Did you have that experience, Malcolm, or have you had that experience? I mean, in some ways, I think we all have, right?
Yeah, well, probably more often than I even realized. I mean, I might have been interacting with artificial intelligence on the internet without even knowing it. And I think maybe that's one of the biggest takeaways, too, is, you know, realizing, particularly on the internet, how much of all of our experiences from e-commerce to social media is either informed by it or you're literally interacting with it.
Well, let me read a comment from Melanie who says, I recently tried to get help from an Amazon order. It was pretty obvious that the chat was with a computer. It was giving me solutions that were not what I needed help with. I found myself arguing out loud with a non-human until I realized how silly and pointless that was. And I know I am not alone in doing this. I mean, Malcolm, that's what you're talking about, right?
Absolutely. And, you know, online, there are bots, artificial intelligence, who are helping you with support or with chat. There are those that are writing reviews online. As Ed has explained to me, there's even artificial intelligence that's trying to combat those fake reviews. And so, you know, our entire kind of experience is either being curated, you know, for certain outcomes, which machine learning and artificial intelligence, you know, controls or informs. But then also there's the more sentient, if you will, experiences of, yeah, say a chatbot that's responding to you. So it's all over the place, honestly. And, you know, we see that with even things like robocalls.
Sure. And Ed, I mean, I obviously we're sort of catching up with where we actually are. Are we close to these robot overlords taking over our lives?
No, I don't worry so much that they're going to take over our lives in the sense of sort of becoming our bosses or masters in any sense. The real concern, the issue that we wanted to talk about and that kept coming up in the podcast is the ways in which we're turning over control or choices to these machines without really thinking much about it. It's not so much that they will be our bosses, but that they will shape the world that we live in ways that we don't stop to think about.
And yeah, did you want to add something?
Yeah, I just wanted to add, I mean, with what we were introducing earlier, there's a certain type of willful ignorance, I think, that you have to accept with artificial intelligence, with this idea of it being more and more integrated into our lives, because we can't always fully understand it, or we can't always fully understand how it came to a conclusion or how it did what it did. There's a certain element of just acceptance that comes with that. And that can be scary, that can be disempowering, that can be illuminating, you know, the idea that maybe humans won't have to have full responsibility over certain decisions. So there's just a lot that comes with that. But I do think there's just a certain, you know, element of the mystery that we all have to accept.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation with our two guests, Malcolm Burnley, that's the voice you just heard, and Ed Felton. They are the co-hosts of a new podcast series. It's called AI Nation, and it is a collaboration between WHYY and Princeton University. Malcolm is a contributing reporter to WHYY, and Ed Felton, professor of computer science, founding director of Princeton Center for Information Technology. He worked in the Obama administration. And again, you can join us. Any questions or comments, send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can pick up the phone and give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. After this short break, Slaughterbots. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking with Malcolm Burnley and Ed Felton, the co-hosts of a new podcast called AI Nation. We're talking about how artificial intelligence is a part of our daily lives. Let me play a clip from AI Nation, and this is a video. It's called Slaughterbots, and it's made by a group, the Future of Life Institute, who you should know are against autonomous weapons. But let's give it a listen. And this is Malcolm Burnley's voice, and then we'll talk right after we hear it.
It starts with a CEO, a handsome, tall, middle-aged guy, giving a presentation on a big stage. A tiny drone zooms out from the wings over toward him.
Your kids probably have one of these, right?
Not quite.
And lands in his palm.
Just like any mobile device these days, it has cameras and sensors. And just like your phones and social media apps, it does facial recognition. Inside here is 3 grams of shaped explosive. This is how it works.
The tiny drone speeds over toward a mannequin on stage left, scans its face, and blows a hole in its forehead.
Did you see that? A $25 million order now buys this. Enough to kill half a city. The bad half. Trained as a team, they can penetrate buildings, cars, trains, evade people, bullets, pretty much any countermeasure. They cannot be stopped.
And things devolve from there.
That is frightening. Ed Felton, let me go to you. That guy's voice is really terrifying. But let me go to you. We're talking about autonomous weapons there, correct?
Yes.
And yeah, are they here? Are they? I can understand from drone technology how that would be at least a next step. Where are we at?
Well, you can look at this video and ask, is there anything depicted here that's fundamentally impossible, that seems like it can't be done based on today's technology? And unfortunately, the answer is no, that sort of thing, if it isn't possible to build today, will be possible for someone to build before too long. But the idea of a weapon that acts on its own, that hunts down and kills a particular target, is really frightening and should be. And it raises some really difficult moral questions about responsibility and about what we can do to control this capability. It is something we should be worried about.
Well, and the fact that this guy is obviously selling this slaughter bot that is going to kill, you know, the bad people in the city. That's not Malcolm House City. You don't have bad people living over here and the good people living over there.
Exactly. We don't always know. And I also, I think one of the questions that autonomous weapons raises too is that maybe in this somewhat more extreme example, we could identify that someone was killed, say, by an autonomous weapon. But, you know, I think there's also the scary future that, you know, we might not know not just who was responsible for it, but, you know, if this was a quote-unquote normal killing, or if this was attributable to an autonomous weapon. It's not always that clear, and there's a lot of gray area as well, where it's not necessarily just a drone flying around with a specific target, but maybe it's an autonomous drone identifying people with facial recognition, and a human has to pull the trigger, if you will. And it raises these interesting questions about how far, you know, we should implement this technology, how far it should be allowed. And I think we're already hearing this on a global level, but there's going to be more and more calls to ban autonomous weapons, whether or not countries decide to sign on to those.
Just because of all the variables, the things that cannot be controlled or sort of programmed for, like Malcolm?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and similar, we talk a little bit in the podcast about this. I mean, you know, we've seen bans on chemical warfare and, you know, other types of warfare that are still used, but, you know, the idea there being international norms, you know, some type of punishment or condemnation when those are used. You know, there's similar discussions happening around autonomous weapons. But as I was just saying, one of the tricky things is I don't think it's as easily identifiable when those are or aren't used.
Ed, let me go back to you. And Malcolm mentioned, you know, the use of facial recognition. Again, this is part of the podcast. And again, raising a whole host of questions about things like racial bias. Now, I think we tend to think of computers as these sort of neutral machines that we, you know, program or use one way or the other. How does bias get factored into artificial intelligence?
Well, it happens in a bunch of ways, and facial recognition is a good example, because there are lots of studies that show that common facial recognition algorithms do make more errors for the faces of people of color. So you might ask, why does that happen? Well, it's a bunch of reasons. One is that these algorithms are designed based on learning from a data set. That is, they're given for facial recognition, they're given a bunch of pictures of people's faces, and the algorithm figures out what features to look for based on analyzing that data. And so if If people of color are underrepresented in that data set, there aren't as many of them in the data set as there are in the real population, then the algorithm will do worse for their faces. That's one way bias can get in. Another way bias can get in is often AI systems are directed to learn based on past human experience. So that is, you're basically telling the AI system to make decisions the way our human decision makers have made them in the past. So for something like, say, admission to school or decisions about housing or employment, the system might be given a bunch of past examples. Well, we gave a loan to this person, but not that person. We hired this person, but not that person, and here are their resumes. And so if you tell the system that what it's supposed to do is mimic the past behavior of humans, and that past behavior of humans was biased, as we know it often usually is, then what you get is an AI system that has that bias baked in.
Because it reflects who we are, correct?
Sure. Like anything,
I mean, it reflects our biases.
It does. And just as in everything else we do, unless we are mindful of this and work actively to reduce the bias, then it will get in there. And if we're not careful, it could be worse in an automated system than it was in a fully a decision based on human decisions.
Ed, and I want to get to you, Malcolm, but Ed, just a follow-up question there. So is this a fixable problem? Is it just a matter of figuring out how to input, I guess, the data so that it deals with some of these built-in biases?
It's not a problem we can eliminate, but it is certainly a problem that we can reduce. We can do better or we can do worse on these bias issues depending on how careful we are. And there's a growing body of engineering methods that are designed to help practitioners identify and try to correct for bias. And so we can do better or worse. And so, you know, when thinking about these issues and risks of bias in AI, it's important to ask not just are we using AI or not, but to ask what are we doing to measure and counteract the bias that will naturally get into this system if we don't pay attention.
Did you want to add something, Malcolm? And I do want to play an episode from AI Nation.
Yeah, just really quick. I mean, with what Ed was saying, you know, we spoke to one guest, Rhea Kaluri, who is a PhD student at Stanford studying AI and bias. And one thing that she said that really opened my eyes is that I gave the example earlier about AI essentially inventing its own form of physics on the fly, which is a very kind of creative or imaginative application. But most uses of AI are actually somewhat, I guess, conservative in their scope when you think about it, and the idea that they're based on human data or based on existing data sets, and the task is to try to make decisions that are along the same lines that humans have made, but perhaps just better. And when you think about it like that, that's somewhat of a conservative, I guess, conception, right? It's kind of reproducing things or producing them better, but it's not fundamentally changing them. So when we think about predictive policing, AI in policing, it can get really problematic.
Sure. Well, let me play another clip from AI Nation. This is from an episode that looked at racial bias in AI. And this is our guest, Malcolm Burnley, telling the story of Najir. Actually, we're hearing Najir Parks. He's a 33-year-old black man from New Jersey, discovered one day that there was a warrant out for his arrest. Let's hear what Najir Parks had to say.
And while she was talking to me, two officers just walked up and asked me to put my hands behind my back. So I turned around, I'm like, for what? They're like, you're under arrest. I'm like, I'm under arrest for what? Like, I came here to see what was going on. I didn't do anything wrong.
The police started questioning Najir, and something was said about assaulting a police officer. At this point, Najir was panicking.
I grew up in the streets most of my life, so I've seen things happen, so I know what kind of things happen when they think you harmed one of their own. If they think you harmed a police officer, they're going to beat the crap out of you when they get you.
He says it seemed like they were already convinced he was guilty. Najir had prior convictions, which he thought was part of the reason. But they also kept saying this thing.
You know what you did. You know you did it. You know the computer's not going to lie.
The computer's not going to lie. What Najir didn't know at the time was that the police had run a photo of a shoplifting suspect through facial recognition software. The man in the photo was several inches taller than Najir. And unlike Najir, he had pierced ears. But the facial recognition software said Najir was a match.
Malcolm, what happened in this story?
Yes, this story really identifies and brings up a lot of issues around predictive policing and artificial intelligence use in it. So Najir Parks was a man, you know, as he explained, found out that there was a warrant for his arrest. He shows up to the police department in New Jersey, in Woodbridge, New Jersey, which, by the way, is a place that he says he had never been before, but is where the crime had been committed. He shows up at the police station to try to clear up the matter. And next thing he knows, he's locked up and he ends up being in jail for 10 days. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that's really... Well, lucky for him, there was a different law in New Jersey around bail that let him out, and he was able to document his alibi and eventually prove his innocence. But if not for that law, it's hard to say where Najir would be. It's hard to say how long he would have been kept in jail, and all on the basis of faulty facial recognition. And, you know, I think it really identifies the risks that we have with trusting this technology too much, in the sense that he did have an alibi, in the sense that he didn't match the physical description in several ways. And yet the police were more than willing to put him in jail as a result of that. So he's now out. You know, he was able to prove his innocence, is now suing the police department along with the state to get some form of compensation back. But, you know, the line is very fine. And I think the one thing, too, is that we didn't know that that police station, or excuse me, that police office was using facial recognition until his false arrest. And so It really speaks to the idea that this is being integrated much more broadly than we even know.
Well, and Ed, we hear Najir saying that the police said to him, you know, where were you? The computers never lie. And it's not like they're lying the way humans lie, but they can be wrong.
Absolutely. These systems are not perfect. They make mistakes. You can measure or estimate how many mistakes they're going to make, but you always have to take what they say with a grain of salt. And if you're making a really important decision about a person's life, like whether to put somebody behind bars, you need more than just the immediate output of one algorithm, right? It's the police might in a different world have run the picture of the person who perpetrated this shoplifting through a facial recognition system. Maybe Najir's name popped up, but then they started asking other questions. Okay, is he the right height? Is he, et cetera? They might have even talked to him, but the real issue here was just over-reliance on this one piece of evidence, this attitude that the computer can't be wrong.
Let me read a couple of comments. In fact, Richard asks, what about the increased use of robotics that is displacing human workers? Malcolm, if I can toss that quickly back to you, that happening?
For sure. I mean, automation, you know, is eliminating a number of jobs. I mean, we particularly see that with lower paying jobs, wage jobs, tipped jobs. I mean, we're even seeing in the restaurant industry, there's now fully automated McDonald's, in the country where there's no human workers. You know, you order at the kiosk, there's machines essentially grilling the hamburgers or however it works. And so we are seeing that in particular, and the burden is going to be unfortunately borne by, you know, women workers, minority workers, and a lot of low paid workers. So that's happening in a variety of industries.
Ed, here's a comment that Mike left us. The idea that these machines are creating their own types of thinking is nonsense. They are just using programs and the information that the programmers have fed into the computers. They aren't really thinking on their own. What do you say?
I mean, I think that is both right, that they are not thinking on their own. They don't think in the same way that we think. And it is just a process of taking a bunch of inputs provided by people and producing some results based on it. But at the same time, the way these things operate is difficult for us to understand. It's not fully understood even by the people who made them. And so it is useful to think about them as if they were sort of intelligent, autonomous entities, even if strictly speaking, they aren't. And in fact, it's really difficult to talk about these systems in a way that is useful without slipping into talking about the machine wants this, the machine is trying to achieve that, the machine is unhappy with something else, even though we know that that's not really the case. They behave as if they're intelligent, even if, strictly speaking, they probably are not.
Malcolm, let's talk a bit about just language, computer language, and how that, I guess, how that works, but also how it's different from the language that the three of us are using on the radio.
Yeah, absolutely. Language was one of the most interesting, I think, aspects of doing the research and putting the podcast together, the degree to which AI can produce language, but maybe not necessarily understand it. And we got a chance to actually play around with what is called GPT-3, which is a natural language processing AI. And what that does is it's able to take a prompt, create language off of it, and even say, hold a conversation. If you type something in, it will reply and generate text. And one of the things that we found was we ran this experiment through of taking some clips from Jurassic Park and running it through this natural language processing to see if it would either complete the text or speak like the characters would speak. And it was able to reproduce the tone and almost cadence of a lot of the characters that are really spot on, but the actual content was really noticeable and just being somewhat gibberish. For example, capturing the anger or even concepts that a character would normally portray in the film, but instead, you know, there are certain words that just simply a human wouldn't use, or certain patterns in the speech. And so language is actually, I think, one of the areas that, you know, really shows the difference between human intelligence and artificial intelligence, and I guess the gap that exists there. And even though, you know, we were talking about Eliza or a chatbot, even though we can, in a very kind of linear way, interact with artificial intelligence in a way that might make it seem like a human, in terms of actually carrying and holding a conversation, I think we're still pretty far away from that.
Well, let's take another short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's a WHYY reporter Malcolm Burnley. Also with us, Ed Felton. He's a Princeton University computer science professor. They are co-hosts of a new podcast called AI Nation. And it's a collaboration between WHYY and Princeton University. And we are picking their brains about where things stand when it comes to AI. And we want to hear from you. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
It's Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Malcolm Burnley and Ed Felton, the co-hosts of a podcast that's a collaboration between Princeton University and WHYY. It is called AI Nation, and it's all about artificial intelligence. Ed, let me just quote something that Ray Kurzweil predicted. This was back in 2014, that by the year 2029, computers AI would reach some human level of intelligence. Computers would have the ability to tell a joke and be funny. I'm quoting here, to be romantic, to be loving, to be sexy. Now, apparently, as we got closer to 2029, he said, no, this isn't going to happen until 2045. But do you see that sometime on our horizon?
I think we do see computers getting closer to being able to, I would say, sort of fake human emotion and those that sort of emotional intelligence. I don't think there's any real sense in which they have that those capabilities, but the ability to fake it actually does seem to be advancing, that machines are able to banter with people to some extent. They're able to detect the emotional state of people and respond in a way that is closer to appropriate. There's a long way to go, but I do think it's a fallacy to think that machines can never function effectively in a characteristically human or emotionally charged kind of situation. They do have the ability to fake it, I think, better and better. So,
well, humans also have the ability to fake it too, right?
I'm sorry?
humans have the ability to fake it too, right? We can do that. Yeah, Malcolm, you wanted to add something.
Yeah, before we left, we were talking about GPT-3, and one thing I failed to explain that I think, you know, hits on what you're talking about is that it's fundamentally about probability is how this functions. So it's based on a huge training data set that where essentially it's sucked up all the text on the internet and learns how people tend to write. So, you know, the probability that if you use the word the, what is going to be the next word? And then so on and so on. So in terms of a computer being sexy, for example, you know, if it had the training data set of all of the quote unquote sexts that are out there on the internet, it could do a really good job of predicting how would a human talk after being responded to like this. And I think we would be pretty shocked that it could get it very accurate. But in terms of having the creativity or ingenuity, and again, these are all terms that, you know, have a lot of human connotations to them, but in terms of having that type of originality, I think that that's the extra piece, and that's kind of the extra frontier that you were identifying with that prediction.
And this,
go ahead.
And there's this really interesting thing we see with GPT-3. You might have thought that a computer generating text, writing text, would kind of be like Mr. Spock on Star Trek, that its language is very sort of precise and formal, but it doesn't sound like a person because it sort of doesn't use language in an idiomatic and casual way the way we do. But in fact, with GPT-3, it's almost the opposite. It sounds fluent and it uses language in a casual and idiomatic way the way that we do. And it's the kind of concepts underlying what it's saying that are fuzzy and weird and sometimes off-putting. So it's pretty much the opposite of what you would have thought. Computers are able to generate a sense of intimacy sometimes in what they say. It's just that the content of what they're saying can be a little bit off.
That's fascinating. Let me play one more clip from AI Nation. And we were talking earlier about proteins and vaccines. This is an English teacher, Irene Yoon. She's discussing how South Korea used AI to monitor her location and her health when she returned to South Korea. And this, of course, was during the pandemic. Let's give it a listen.
Irene Yoon is an English teacher in South Korea who returned to the country in April.
And they have you download this app on your phone, which you have to, you know, allow permission to always, like, know your location, basically, 24/7.
She did this before a mandatory two-week quarantine at a place approved by the government.
I have a valid long-term visa, and because of that, I had the option of staying at Airbnb, or if I had a house here, I could stay at my house, or I think even a relative's house.
Irene chose the Airbnb. While she was there, she had to update her temperature on the app twice a day and write down any symptoms she was feeling. She also communicated with a public health worker assigned to her case. Violating quarantine had consequences.
So several people got caught by turning their phone off or leaving their phone at home and then walking outside.
These kind of stories were all over John Lim's Facebook feed.
Normally, if you do it once, they'll give you a fair warning. You do it twice or three times, you'll get fined $10,000, I think it is.
And that's Malcolm Burnley's voice there. Malcolm, let me go back to you just as kind of fill in some of the blanks there. So we're talking about South Korea, and certainly early on in the pandemic, they did a much better job than most other countries containing the virus. The trade-off, I guess, was that people had to give up lots of information and to be tracked so that, I guess, the government knew what they were doing and where they were.
That's right. I mean, I felt really naive learning about all this just compared to the U.S. response, because Ed and I had spent a bunch of time talking about a future pandemic and what that might look like with AI kind of enabling different responses. And then lo and behold, a lot of that was already happening in South Korea over the course of 2020 and 2021. And so you're exactly right. South Korea never had to fully shut down its economy, for example, or impose, you know, broad, huge quarantines. Instead, what they did was hyper-targeted COVID response as well as contact tracing. So if a stranger tested positive, and then they would go back and find all of their cell data, pull all of their financial transactions, and basically put together a picture of any type of person they might have interacted with. So people would get a notification from the government saying, you know, you were in an elevator with, you know, whatever stranger 2 weeks ago, you need to come and get tested. And it would suddenly become mandatory. And so, yeah, I mean, those are these huge trade-offs between privacy and safety in a number of ways that I think South Korea, you know, really highlighted with how they handled the response.
Here's a related question. I'll put this to you, Ed Felton. This is from Bernie. He says, I've noticed in recent years that many street intersections have video cameras on traffic signal poles for capturing images of approaching vehicles. Also, the Pennsylvania Turnpike has them at every exit. I'm concerned about how our local, state, and federal governments are using this massive amount of facial biometrics. Can you shed some light on this, Ed?
Unfortunately, I can't shed a lot of light on what's happening specifically in Pennsylvania. And this is true in a lot of places in the U.S. and around the world. We see these cameras or other kinds of sensors out in public, and you can't look at this system and see where the data is going or how it's being used. Probably the traffic cameras might be used for things like red light enforcement. They might be used to help prepare traffic reports so people know when the freeway is crowded or when someone needs to get help because they had a breakdown. But there are all kinds of other ways they could be used. And in many cases, the data sets are being accumulated by government bodies, and we don't know how they might be used in the future.
Well, and Tom asks, this is interesting, can the guests discuss the successes of people using AI in an interactive and collaborative way to enhance performance of both people and AI algorithms, i.e. things like surgery? And I don't want people to go away with the idea that this is all bad, bad, bad. Malcolm, can you shed some light on some things that we should feel optimistic about?
Yeah, for sure. And I think medicine, while that's also a major concern regarding privacy and data, I think the use of medicine and AI is probably, at least for me, was one of the most optimistic or illuminating about the positive uses. You know, outside of the protein folding problem and fast-tracking vaccine development, which are very real, you know, another just more, I guess, like clerical use that I hadn't thought of was we spoke to one researcher who's put in place this AI platform for doctors and hospital workers to essentially be able to sort through the reams and reams of scientific papers that exist to, you know, highlight, identify what's pertinent information, what's duplicative, and also identify gaps in research. And it's essentially like having an AI research assistant, you know, right with you, so that, you know, if you're a current practitioner, you know, you don't have to be devoting your weekends or nights necessarily to just reading through scientific journals for certain things. And, you know, that's an example of something that's just, you know, a very voluminous task that, you know, humans can do, but can be, you know, vastly improve our response to not just a pandemic, but potentially, you know, even just a relationship with a patient. And what that would ideally do is free up doctors, nurses, staff to have the human to human interactions while allowing computers to kind of assist with some of the more things that at least can be automated. So in that sense, you know, hopefully it lets humans be better at their jobs as opposed to eliminating jobs.
And anything you want to add to that?
Sure. There are a lot of uses of AI just routinely all through our economy. So a good example of this is companies that deliver things to our homes. They make extensive use of AI for routing and scheduling and planning. And what that lets them do is it lets them get the packages to our homes faster. It lets them do it using less energy with a lower carbon footprint and generating less traffic that slows other people down. So in a lot of ways, many of the systems that we interact with are faster and more efficient and make better use of resources because of the hidden use of AI to optimize them. And we really should not discount how much better a lot of things we interact with are just because of these routine and uncontroversial uses of what the technology can do.
We're almost at the end of the show when we haven't talked about the thing that we use the most, which is social media, you know, our phones. I've got devices all over my table here as I'm talking with the two of you. And I guess it's so obvious, Malcolm, because we use it every day, but anything we should think about that maybe we haven't thought about or you hadn't thought about these devices that are connecting us to each other and rest of the world?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, there's still so much we don't know or don't understand about how social media platforms are curating, recommending things to us. I mean, I think I'm still stuck in a maybe antiquated idea of what, say, Facebook, how it recommends things to you. And that was very eye-opening over the course of this podcast to find out that, you know, the recommendations are for groups, for example, are typically not based on what your friends or what groups your friends have joined. Rather, you know, making assumptions based on your profile, based on the data that they have collected about you, which could involve your political persuasion, which could involve not just your hobbies, but could involve things like, you know, your financial bracket. And to understand that everything that's being popping up on your screen is probably informed less by the kind of community ethos that I think a lot of social media companies want to perpetuate, and more based on how they can extract either money or simply keep you on the site the longest. And that's really the priority in most cases.
Well, and Ed, it's also, I mean, with some of these groups, it is, as you say in this podcast, about grievances. It's, you know, these groups where conspiracy theories can magnify themselves and have an extraordinary effect. I think we're seeing it in our political system.
Sure. The algorithms that these sites use are trying to figure out how to show you things that will keep you engaged on that site. Right. And often for many people, what will keep you engaged is information that gets you angry or information that gets you information that gets you riled up, or information that confirms what you are already inclined to believe. And so the result is different people might see entirely different worlds on the same site, and worlds that, if we're not careful, can just encourage the worst, our worst inclinations.
And it is so interesting, and it still shocks me, and I'll put this back to you, Ed Felton. You know, if I'm on my Facebook page and I click something, you know, a product that I see, lo and behold, within an hour, I'm getting, you know, similar products being directed right at me.
And not just on Facebook necessarily, but all kinds of other places you go, I assume. There is this huge, people often use the word ecosystem, of companies and technologies that is designed to measure what we are interested in and to show us ads or show us content that's designed to appeal to that. This is not, it's not like reading an old school newspaper where everyone in town is seeing the same content, or indeed listening to the radio where everyone listening to the show hears the same thing. It potentially, with these technologies, each person is seeing something that's tailored to them, but not necessarily based on what they want or what would make them happy, but on what some set of algorithms think will get them to stay engaged with the site or to buy something.
And Malcolm, I'm giving you the last word. So what was your sort of major takeaway having worked on this AI Nation podcast?
Oh, that's a big one. I mean,
it is a big one.
Being the kind of sci-fi geek, you know, I had all these very dystopian ideas of what AI could be. And, you know, while maybe those aren't technologically impossible, I think the main fear is probably misplaced. And it's about how human actors, institutions, companies may be misusing this technology versus the technology kind of coming to life and you know, taking over, if you will. And so I think people just being a lot more aware of what the technology can and can't do, but more importantly, who's pulling the levers of it is how we really need to think about this.
Well, we have to leave it there. Malcolm Burnley, Ed Felton, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times. Their podcast is AI Nation. Gentlemen, thanks so much.
Thanks for the great conversation.
Thanks for having us on, Marty.
You're very welcome. And thank you for joining us. Our engineer today, Diana Martinez. The Radio Times producers, Debbie Bilder, Kelsey Hansen, and for the last time today, John Ahrens. In fact, we have to say goodbye to producer John Ahrens, who has been with Radio Times for almost 7 years. He came to us from WYPR, the public radio station in Baltimore. John has been such a vital, creative, and frankly delightful part of the Radio Times team. He's an original, lively, outside-the-box thinker with a unique way of seeing the world. He's hilariously funny and kept us in stitches for most of those years. He also has an encyclopedic knowledge of The Simpsons and all the episodes, which came in handy both on and off the air. He's also a gifted editor and musician. He has left the big city for a rural life in New England. I thank him for all the ideas he brought to the show, how much he cared about Radio Times, and for his big open-hearted friendship with the Radio Times team and his colleagues at WHYY. Thank you, John. We're going to miss you. I'm Artie Moskowain.